Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00024. Recorded on February 28, 2023. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas. A buzzard blinked. A buzzard blinked. Chapter 24.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
I got an offer the other day from my wife's uncle. He's an old-timer. He was well into his 70s. And he's got a lot of old-timey stuff, right? Old-timey stuff. And every once in a while, he'll come around, like, offer me up something here, offer me up something there. It's pretty cool, you know? And he offered me this walk-behind tiller. It's kind of out of the blue. It's really not been up in discussion or anything. Hey, I got this tiller. You want the tiller? And I went and looked at it, right? Now, it's this old thing. It's a old White Outdoors, right? A company called White Outdoors, a walk-behind tiller. You can't really hardly read anything on it. It's fucking old. It may be like 1960s old. I'm talking old. It's old. It's rusted and faded. He said he got it off, I think, one of the neighbors so many years ago who was just getting rid of it. And when he got it, it turned on and worked and la-da-da. Dude's very mechanical. And I was like, well, you know what? I don't want junk because then it's going to sit around in my yard. I could actually use it. I could till out a garden. We got a big enough backyard to, you know, wheel a tiller back there and start going crazy and save a lot of bother, you know? And, yeah, he said he's going to try to get it up and going. If he gets it up and going, I'm going to be gardening this year again. You know, but this time, like, down in the ground. I had a lot of planters. Me and wife put up these planters. I got this little privacy fence in the backyard. Not around it, but in it. That kind of cordons off a particular section. It's where the boys used to hide behind and smoke weed. they gone, and we still got the fence up there, and I came up with this idea to kind of get, like, these long planters and hang them up on the fence and grow jalapenos out of them. That's what we did. I get, like, a pepper garden that hangs on the fence there, right? It's like my eighth wonder of the world, right? My hanging gardens of Post-Harlan, Texas, right? And, but I didn't put anything in the ground, you know? I mentioned with my Home Depot buckets how we tried to grow tomatoes last year, get them raised up off the ground, right? Really, a quick, cheap, raised garden because we got, we just had to get them put down over the weekend, actually. Little Chico, Chihuahua, who was kind of territorial and liked to hike his leg up on everything, and just not the kind of animal that you could trust around plants. He'd be pissing on them for sure. And then if it's not him, then the pit bull, Henry, he'll trample him. He won't piss on him, but he will just run right over him if he hears a sound, you know, and you can't stop that boy. So, you know, just to put garden in the ground in my yard, it really ain't going to work out. I got to, like, put barriers up and shit like that. But if, you know, if I'm going to have a tiller that works and the man's going to go through the bother to get it up and running, well, fucking A. We'll carve out a decent-sized little garden and start growing shit back there. Now, you know, we're in a suburb, really a city, right? We're in a city neighborhood. It's kind of suburban. I mean, we got the tiniest patch of front lawn in the yard, which technically I think would, at least in my book, call it a suburb. But we are, like, in the downtown neighborhoods in the city where we live, and yeah, it's damn close to being a city neighborhood, if it ain't one. But anyway, we happen to have, for whatever reason, on our side of our block, very long backyards, like you wouldn't expect to have in that kind of neighborhood. And there's room to do shit. I could plant a garden. I could put up a chicken coop. I could put a serious outbuilding along with sheds that we already have, and you know, there's shit that can be done back there in spite of what's already been done. But I gotta kind of get that bug up my ass to like get up and like start doing outside shit. Now, it's always good for the soul, you know, work outside, get in the dirt. It's a good thing to do. When you start getting the results come in, when shit starts growing and you start eating out of your garden, of course, that's great. And if you're fortunate enough to have enough to give away, that's great. So that's kind of hanging, you know. And, you know, we were growing stuff last year. Every year, a little bit more than the year before. We just try a little this, a little that. And, you know, the whole process gets larger. But last year was a fucking dud. Just had a horrible, horrible growing season for 2022. We had a mini drought come through in the summertime where, yeah, it was like 100 degrees every day. It wouldn't rain for like months on end. Usually when that happens, you're in like a five-year period, right? No, but it was just like 3, 4, 5 months of just dryness. But it was brutal. Like when I say it didn't rain, there weren't even clouds in the sky. So the sun was just pounding down all day, every day. And everything just withered up and died. Our lawn got killed in the front, got killed in the back. Dead. I don't mean dormant. I mean fucking dead. Like, it's got to regrow. It's either got to be resodded or just a new game plan. And that's why the garden sounds good to me, because that'll be a chunk of change that I don't have to regrow or whatever. It's eventually going to be a mud pit, you know. But right now, there's still, like, you know, dead grass, dead straw, like, hanging on to it. But it kicks up as, you know, with the wind. I don't know. It's just... It was a horrible, horrible fucking 22 year for growing anything. And nothing worked. You know, shit that we watered every day. We had our jalapenos and chili peppers up in the garden hanging from the fence, you know. The eighth wonder of the world. And, you know, watering them every day, twice a day, it didn't matter. Just a brutal sun coming down without interruption during the day. It was just too much for anything. And plus we had some kind of critter decide to go, maybe a squirrel, I don't know. It was starting to tear up the plants, too. I guess it was struggling to find things to eat, you know, whatever the fuck it was. But nothing worked. Nothing worked for us this past season. We'll try again. The year before it was great. I tried to experiment with preserving, you know, like jarred, you know, canning. And we get these red, what they call Fresno peppers. They're jalapenos, red jalapenos. I love them things, right? They're jalapenos, but they don't taste grassy like a regular jalapeno does. They have the same heat. They're no hotter, no less hot, but they have a little more rounded taste, a little sweeter, just not so grassy, right? The red makes a difference, and they're really good. I really like them, and, you know, we were using them for chili and just everything. We still had a bunch of them left over, right? So I had this idea of getting like mason jars or ball jars or whatever. My wife handled it. She went to the store and got some stuff. And you know, I put them in oil, you know. And then one of the canisters, after a while, we started like pulling them out and using them, frying them up for food. And one of them I opened up and then closed up, put it back in the refrigerator, you know, after the oil had cooled. And it just kind of, it's like this fat now. It's just like fucking lard with red peppers in it, right? But still, eventually, just got to take it out and fry it up. And I think that time's coming with the pseudo-vegan Lenten fast diet that we're on currently for the next month or so more. So we still got a little taste left of a good growing season, which 2021 was. And I remember, like, when we were taking in all that stuff in 2021, we just got to this point of, like, proliferation. All of a sudden, like, you pull a couple of peppers and a couple of more, and then all we just had, like, this abundance, right? I remember, like, my wife had, like, this kind of tray that was just full of all these brilliant, glowing, shining, healthy, deep red peppers. And we had cayennes in there too, also red, right? Everything was red, just beautiful, right? Beautiful, rich color. And all I could just think of was the word, Italian word, abbondanza, abbondanza, right? It's I'm not Italian, but I grew up around Italian things. I grew up outside of New York City, northern New Jersey. Everything is fucking Italian, and if it ain't, it's Irish or Jewish or black, right? But there's so much Italian, like the American heritage in this country is from that area, that the advertising was often geared towards Italian people up there, right? And I remember, I guess it was the late 70s, possibly early 80s, there was a brand of Italian foods called Mama Celeste. I don't know if they still exist or not. I really should have looked it up, but I did not. But it was called Mama Celeste, and they had a commercial, and they used that word, abbondanza. And it means abundance, right? Something in abundance. And that's all I could think of when I just saw this big tray full of all these rich-looking peppers. And it's like there's this abundance. And I'm trying to think of Mama Celeste foods that I actually ate. They had like frozen pizza, but they had other stuff too. And I don't remember eating it. I couldn't tell you whether I liked it or not. So we'll just move on from it. But we just had like this abundance of the peppers that year compared to last year where we had nothing. Everything was burnt up and it sucked. And I got a bunch of good plants, a great variety, a lot of shit. I had Carolina Reapers and ghost peppers, you know, the Bhujalakia from India. All really, really hot stuff. And I had some big plans for some outstanding chili. Did not happen. Really. So I'm going to try it again. You know, quit. And maybe I'll do it in a big old garden this time around. We'll see how that that old tiller turns out, if it turns out. You know, just like anybody else. So, yeah, abundance. We had it in peppers and shit one year. I've always got an abundance. I got like much stuff, right? I got a lot of stuff. I consider myself to be working poor, but I got all kinds of toys and things. You know, just shit. I don't mean like toys. I just tools to get things done with, and a zillion projects in mind that I never seem to get to. You know, it's just much stuff and many projects. Just an abundance. I don't have time enough for everything I've got and everything I've got planned. And like I see, like I mentioned in the previous episode, like dormant hobbies. Like I haven't been able to get to a lot of the stuff in my workshop, like ammo reloading and leather work, you know, trying to learn how to like create gun holsters, for example. That was my next step. You know, I was going to make myself a shoulder harness for carrying my big revolvers, you know, two at a time, you know, two gun it, right? Double down instead of buying it. And you know, like, I can't, I got like these Taurus revolvers, again, bottom shelf, 357 mag and a 44 mag. They're virtually the same gun, but they shoot the, different size cartridges. But I want one on the left and one on the right. And I got my reasons and I don't need to tell you why. But I can't get holsters for Taurus guns. They're hard to come by. For pistols, not so much, but for the revolvers, it's a pain in the dick. And so I got to make my own. And I decided, well, I'm going to go through that much of a bother. I'll also just learn how to make the harness that goes over the shoulders with it, do the whole thing. That's a project that's been sitting in limbo for, like, shit, I don't know, 15 months? I just haven't gotten to it. But one of many examples of dormancy, dormant projects, dormant capabilities. And it's just like, when I'm not doing that shit and I know it's there, it starts to feel like wasteful. You know, it's like I put out the money for this shit when I could have put it out for something else. And now I'm not doing that, therefore it is waste, right? I don't like that sense that I had spent poorly and not followed through with my ideas. With me, it's not usually the case. I sincerely intend to do this shit. I want to do it. I just can never get to it. I've accrued too many things, and then I get too many problems that get in the way, you know, and leave me in just no time. So I got to, like, stop creating new hobbies and new projects and just fulfill what I've already stepped into, right? That's difficult. I've got a wild imagination and really a surprising lust for life and just the things in the world, you know, to engage myself with, and to learn and try and create. I am a fairly creative person, as it turns out. Who knew, right? But when those compulsions sit dormant and start to look wasteful, then it starts to be a matter of what? Extravagance, right? Extravagance. And yeah, I could possibly be something of an extravagant person at times. You know, if I go back over my life history, it wouldn't be too much of a reach to regard myself in that light. So I've always got to be careful, you know. I've always been an all or nothing kind of guy. And sometimes you can spend all and do nothing with it, right? And that's kind of like what I'm facing in myself right now. Almost everything I start into, I get into it right away. And I do create something. But I don't continue and then perfect the skill. You know, most people have one, maybe two hobbies. I got like a fucking dozen. I listed them previously. And I even forgot about some, you know. Extravagant. I got a dictionary definition for you. You know how that is. Lavish or imprudent in spending money. Right? That's the basic premise, you know, the exceeding reasonable bounds, straying beyond limits, you know, and that, you know, there's a little bit of me in there, and I've always got to watch out for that, you know, there's that idea of extravagance. And, you know, a really good example of that which is extravagant is scripture from the Bible, right? New Testament, if you know the story. Open your Bibles, if you will, to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15. Go down a few verses. Somewhere in there, there's going to be a story of the prodigal son, as it's known, right? For one thing, the prodigal son. Maybe you know this story, maybe you don't. But the basic idea is that there was a wealthy father who had two sons, and he owned, you know, a large home with all this acreage, and just wanted for nothing, right? Very wealthy guy. And one of the sons decided that he wanted to take up his inheritance from his father early, you know, not wait till the father died, till the time was right for him to take ownership of all this stuff. He wanted to get his inheritance now and go figure out life for himself. So the father gave up all the inheritance, gave him this stuff, and the guy went off and squandered it, right? He went a-hoeing, and he went a-gambling, and just pissed everything away. And found himself destitute in a really bad condition. And he learned hard lessons, you know. And part of that lessons was those lessons was the need to, like, stay within propriety, to walk between the lines, to stand by the father and do as the father commanded, right? So it's all analogy, right? It's all talking about God and his children, right? There's one child was the prodigal son. Now, as it was, he decided that to humbly return to the father, all apologetic and stupefied and sorrowful, and you know, bow before him and really just set himself up as a ranch hand from here on out, to basically pay back what he squandered, right? And on the other hand, you had the son who stayed by the father and always did what he was told. And he was hateful because the father was so receptive to the son. Not only did he take him in, he took him in as a son, as an heir. He did not fulfill the request to put him in as a hand, an ordinary worker, a laborer. But he took him back in his son, as his son, as an heir, as a prince, and lavished him with all kinds of good stuff and threw a party. Get the fatted calf and celebrate. My son has returned, right? There's a lot to the story, and I'm not going to pick it apart, you know. But one thing to notice is what God's focus was in the whole thing. See, the one son who was like, quote unquote, the good son who didn't take off, didn't squander the money, didn't, you know, speed up the idea of his father dying so he could have it all. He did what he was told. But his focus still yet was on the stuff, not the father and not the lost brother. He wasn't looking at the people. He wasn't looking at the soul inside the person as what really mattered in the grand scheme of things, right? It was still all about the stuff to this guy. And the case was even so with, obviously, the prodigal son, who took off and squandered everything. It was the stuff that he wanted to go squander. And once everything was squandered, he was humiliated to go back home, having had squandered everything, because in his mind, it was also all about the stuff. But in the father's mind, the guy who actually owned it all, who was the one who was wealthy, right, who had no want for anything, it was not about the stuff. It was about the son, right? It was about what was lost and now is found. It's like the Amazing Grace song. I once was lost and now I'm found. And I can't sing that shit, so forgive me. But I'm just trying to give you a little idea of the melody so you have an idea. Because, you know, you don't have to be of Christian background to know that song. That's, you know, when they break out the bagpipes for, like, a dead fireman in New York City. That's the song that they play, right? One of them anyway, Amazing Grace. But the idea of something that was lost and now is found, and it's a reason to celebrate, right? That's what God cared about. And when I say God, the father in the story was analogous of God the father, right? Anyway, without getting too lost in all of that, you know, what was lost is now found. And that's my segue into something that occurred recently. I mentioned it on a previous episode. I found some old fictional writings, right? I was starting to write a fiction novel that had some wheels to it. It really had some wheels to it, but I lost a lot of the stuff. I thought it was all gone, but I found a couple of odd little, it was ASP files for a website that I had put together years ago. When I say years ago, we're going back 15 years. It's like, 07, 15, 16 years ago. And I kept it on my old piece of shit laptop, which I still have, but those files are not there. But on my old, not such a piece of shit desktop, that's actually older than that laptop, I did stumble accidentally on a couple of old ASP files. That's like similar to HTML stuff for websites, right? Notepad files with website, the browser information on it, and in the commands and design structure tags, here are chapters of a story. And I've got five chapters of the beginnings of this book. There's still many missing. I don't know that they'll ever turn up. I never thought that these would turn up. But what I said I would do is go in for the next 5 weeks forward, or five episodes forward, I would read one chapter per episode from these lost files. So we'll see how that flies, all right? So we were talking about what was lost and found, right? I got these old writings from this old PC, and it's sort of kind of like my own personal digital, Dead Sea Scrolls, right? It's something you didn't really know. You knew it existed, but you didn't know it was there, and there it is, and it maybe changes the game, you know? I don't know. I don't know what to really make of it, what's going to become of it, but I'm putting it into action immediately. Right? I found them. I'm going to do something with it right here, right now. And like I said, it was good shit, and it had some wheels. Whether I'll ever go out and do a fiction novel at this point, I kind of have my doubts. But again, who knows, right? Who knows? The capability is there. The time, not so much. But who knows? So I'm going to try something here with these podcasts, kind of combine some of my hobbies and talents together and see what we got, right? Now, like I said, these came from an old website, right? These were website files. I had it was what I call my Tubuku, T-B-U-K-U website. It does not exist. Don't go looking for it. It was not a big deal. Nobody really looked at it. A few people who were close to me knew what was going on. And what I was doing was just putting things of my interest out there. And also amongst those things were the chapters of these stories as they were being written, right? I was putting them up online. So that's why I had them on these ASP files. It was a Tubuku website. That's what it's called, Tubuku. And I got that. That was actually... that's a reference, a pop culture reference from the movie from the mid-80s, Marine Corps movie, as it was, the Full Metal Jacket, a Stanley Kubrick movie, right? Full Metal Jacket, Vietnam story, that half of it was basic training in Parris Island, South Carolina, which I went through, so I could verify the validity of everything in that movie. It was really spot on, right? It was, Arlie Ermey, came to notoriety. He was the drill instructor in the movie, right? The senior drill instructor. In the other half of the movie was taking place in Vietnam during the war, and there was a scene during that Vietnam part of it that involved one of the characters, one of the infantrymen in the platoon, who was a black dude who went by the nickname of 8-Ball. You know, go figure, I guess. And he was involved with a conversation with a Vietnamese prostitute that involved the subject of Tubuku. Now, you can go and watch that movie on your own and figure out what the fuck I'm talking about. I'm not going to mention it here. But that's where that old moniker came from. It was actually a tag that I used in gaming, right? That was my name, my gaming name. I used to play these old war type of games from the Nova Logic series of games. That was like, the late 90s and through the 2000s. And I don't know what's become of it. Probably nothing. But they had a line of military games. They were first-person shooter, multiplayer. They were the predecessor to all these, oh my God, the most popular wargaming games on any, I can't even think of the line. Holy crap, my mind just went blank. It happens, because I tell you, I'm getting older, right? It'll come to me. Call of Duty, right? Call of Duty, right? These were Call of Duty type of games. But they were kind of pre-Call of Duty. Call of Duty started to spring up right around while these Nova Logic games were already out. And they're very, very similar, but a little different. The Nova Logic games, kind of more open world. Like, you can get out and roam around. You could sniper somebody from, 3,000 meters and shit like that, you know. Endless maps, basically. Where Call of Duty is kind of really tight, more close quarter type of stuff. And of course, you know, the technology improved as time went along, and the Call of Duty graphics were a lot better. But whatever, I don't mean to compare the two. I'm just, the fact is, I played those Nova Logic games from the Delta Force 2 on through. I played a lot of Black Hawk Down, and then there was like an add-on to Black Hawk Down called Team Saber. I played that for a bit too. And I was involved. Like, I was in squads. In fact, I ran a squad with this one guy, right? He went by the moniker of Machine, with fancy lettering, right? He was a dude from New Orleans, and we built this squad together. It was pretty good, and it was a buzz for a little while. And, yeah, so we were kind of friends. It's like online friends. You never meet a person, but you do all this planning. Online, you had like a webcam and shit like that. You would have these conversations, and you'd have like all these squad meetings that you were in charge of, and yeah, you sort of kind of get to know a person to one extent or another. One of the most unlikely things I think I experienced in my life happened one time when I was living down in Georgia, and I was starting to get into driving a truck, right? I'd gone to a school, I think I mentioned before, Conyers, Georgia. I was going up to start orientation at a job for a company up in a town way up in North Georgia called Tunnel Hill, right? Tunnel Hill, Georgia. And I was up there, I was going through orientation. Orientation's like a lot of filling out papers and videos and administrative stuff like that. And they had an intercom system in there, and they would, like, you would have just people trying to make contact with other people, and there was drivers coming in and out, and it was like some secretary woman or somebody, some administrative woman's voice came over the intercom. It was calling for this dude by this particular name, which as soon as I heard it, I was like, it rang bells, because I knew a guy with the same fucking name. And I knew a guy with the same fucking name who quit his previous profession while I knew him to go off and drive a truck. And that's where I lost touch with him. I was like, wait a minute. This guy with this name driving a truck. What are the fucking odds? So I go hunt them down. We get like a break from our orientation. People go out smoking cigarettes, whatever. And like I went to like the administrative desk, and I was like, hey, you said this name up here. Where can I find this guy? His truck's out there. It's number so and so. You know, I went out there and I found this truck. I knock on the door. The guy opens, rolls down the window. And I just looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said, motherfucker. This is the dude, right? It was the dude from my fucking Delta Force squad. And, just the unlikeliness of it. I mean, it didn't really go anywhere. I never talked to him since. Hey, come on in. Got up in his truck, and he had it like set up like a porno palace. It was just, he had like a little television system with a CD or DVD player. He had porn running on it. He had like naked women posted on the ceiling, and I was like in somebody's knuckle fucking palace, basically, and I was really uncomfortable about it. And I kind of just got myself out of there and kind of just left that behind me. I dusted myself off, and it didn't really play out all that well. I'm not that kind of guy. I just, even in my worst days, you know, as I say, when I was an Antichrist motherfucker, which at that point in time I still was, I was yet not that kind of person, you know. And anyway, you know, so that's Tunnel Hill, Georgia, right? My little mathematical impossibility in Tunnel Hill, Georgia, as that story goes. And I guess, well, we're talking about Georgia. I guess that's a decent segue, because this story, the first release of my chapter one from an unnamed book. I've called the first chapter, which I'm going to read to you. I got to dig it up, but I'm going to read it to you. It's called A Buzzard Blinked, right? A Buzzard Blinked. So here we go with the first round. If I could find it. of Uncle Maverick's bedtime stories. Okay, all right. And I mention this as a segue to Georgia because the story at least begins in Georgia. It never got to an end, so I don't know what happens. But I lived in Georgia. Go figure, right? A buzzard blinked. Sit back and let me read to you here. It'd probably take about 10 minutes or so. The ancient Egyptians identified it with a major deity in their religion as the Eye of Ra. In Hindu religious literature, it is notably mentioned as the visible form of God that one can see every day. Many Greek myths personify it as a titan named Helios, who wore a shining crown and rode a chariot across the sky, causing day. The Roman Empire adopted Helios into their mythology as Sol. It was also worshipped in many pre-Columbian societies in the Americas. Modern science refers to it as a third-generation star that is composed of hydrogen, helium, and trace quantities of other elements. In Georgia, it is known simply as the sun. And on any given summer afternoon, it is oppressively hot and relentlessly bright, and little else about it matters. Under such a sun on a lazy day some time back, the rotted remains of an armadillo baked into the roadside clay along a still byway in lapping sheaths of papery gray leather. A crushed cola can off toward the dusted shoots of straw grass that lined the way, reflected the bright back into the heavens. Out from the weeds, a knotted wooded post dangled two broken strands of rusted barbed wire. A flattened wooden gate straddled the overgrown remnants of what had once been a driveway. A tilted white plywood sign, hand-printed red, peeling with age and dusted with neglect, dangled from an old steel clothesline post and announced, "Peaches, pecans, hot boiled peanuts, Mayhaw jelly, Vidalia onions." Yellow jackets buzzed all about the sign. The short driveway faded to a straw grass and briar before an abandoned produce stand meshed with kudzu. A flock of buzzards perched motionless on the withered, diseased branches of a lone pecan tree, and two stragglers drifted listlessly above the rolls of desolate fields to the west. Not the slightest of breezes blew to ruffle their mangy feathers or to lift their drift. Across the road stood a vast forest of tall pine, stretching north and south as far as the eye could trace, and reaching inward to the east through the glowing rows of green canopy and orange carpet, and disappearing into black darkness despite the blazing summer sun. The silence was slowly shaken by a distant rumble and groan from the south. A buzzard blinked in the pecan tree. Down the highway, rushing northbound, a red and white tractor trailer pushed along over the subtle clines. As it drew near, its engine moaned and its trailer rattled. A buzzard lifted to the sky. As the truck passed, it displaced the still air in its wake, and the papery flaps of armadillo wavered. As it sped off into the north, it left a message on the rear trailer door. "I got balls." Bouncing along from the trailer bumper hung a clever creation of duct tape formed into the unmistakable shape of an oversized scrotum. The truck raced off into the horizon, and the death-like tranquility was momentarily restored. One of the buzzards returned to perch with the flock. Two continued to float to skies above the old roadside stand, surveying the fields and forests. Not a mouse, nor a rat, not a mole, not a snake, No other armadillos, no deer carcass, no dying bobcat or hog. There lie nothing in this range but for another vehicle approaching, this one from the north, this one a van, a blue van. It rode up as far as the stand and pulled aside, stopping beside the knotty fence post and flattened gate. A buzzard blinked. The armadillo paid it no mind. The engine of the van idled quietly. The driver's side window was opened, and a hand burst out to flip a cigarette ash. The driver was a man. He wore a baseball cap, backwards, and was roughly 3 days unshaven. He peered through round black sunglasses at a road map unfurled across the steering wheel. He hung the cigarette from his lip and traced a line along the map. A hunk of ash broke off and fell to his lap. He puffed on and traced on. Smoke poured out of the window. A logger truck rolled by from the south, its large iron spines holding no load, and was trailed closely by a sheriff's patrol car. The armadillo did its dance, and the cigarette smoke whisked off quickly alongside the van. The driver of the van turned his face to the road and lost another heap of ash to his lap. He folded the map haphazardly and jammed it between the passenger seat and the center console. He looked left over his shoulder, out the window. Another logger truck, this one fully loaded, of endless Georgia pine, sped up angrily beside and by him from the north, flicking small pieces of bark off in its wake. It roared off into the south. The van geared up and returned to the road, raising the inevitable clay dust and trampling the armadillo along the way. Along the highway, as the van came to speed, spaced apart every 30 yards or so, were low-posted signs half-covered in straw grass and briar, warning inattentive drivers that they need to turn back now for hot-boiled peanuts, mayhaw jelly, and the like. The blue van pushed on deeper into the south. The fields to the west gave way to a forest not a mile along, and in no time the van was surrounded on all sides by the pines. The byway ran long and straight through row after row of tall, straight loblollies, with nothing other than mile markers and a sign noting some tea water trickle of a creek the roadway crossed over. But for an RV with Michigan plates and an old couple from Florida and a bronze sedan, the blue van encountered no other signs of life for miles. Eventually the forests on all sides began to thin and recede from the road somewhat, yielding narrow parallel stretches of unkempt fields. On these fields, raising up from overgrown and dried grasses, were an odd assortment of dilapidated structures. A misaligned row of seemingly abandoned shacks and trailers, some boarded up, some overtaken by ivy, laid in tribute to a time that was and is no longer. A small abandoned church, windows shattered, white paint peeling, and side walls warped, stood beside a tiny graveyard where the briar stood taller than the memory. A long red chicken coop, faded pink by the sunlight and overrun by the insidious kudzu, lay dormant, collecting wasps and rats and snakes. A forgotten old tractor lay in a rusty heap in the weeds along the coop. The van drew near to an intersection, and in the open patch in the northeast corner stood a tall billboard with a faded, illegible message. A small sign nailed into its leg hung crooked. It said, "Rent this space," and posted a phone number below which had been roasted indistinguishable. Across the way, beyond the chicken coops, waited another aborted roadside produce stand, complete with sun-baked signs for peaches and Vidalia onions. The van slowed into the intersection and then released its brakes and continued through. About 100 yards along, its brake lights flared again and it pulled off to the right, paused for a moment, and pulled a U-turn. Returning to the intersection, it passed a low line of hot-boiled peanut signs, mostly lost to the weeds. Another sign, taller, larger, and bolder, rose up out of the same weeds and directed oncoming traffic to the Creekside Inn, with an arrow pointed left. The van flashed a blinking amber turn signal, and at the crossroads headed west. Along the way, the forest remained receded from the road, perhaps 100 yards, give or take. A small white modular home, apparently occupied, sat in the field and flew two flags from its doorway, the red, white, and blue flag of the old Confederacy, and a red flag with a white bulldog on it. The yard was mown and treeless. A white pickup truck was parked out front. Down the side road further, a trailer home, again apparently occupied, though not as neatly kept. The road crawled up a subtle incline, and at the top stood a tall sign indicating Motel in large letters. Below the tall sign sat a low white ground sign with changeable letters, which at that time, on that day, told approaching vehicles of daily rates, weekly rates, vacancy, pool, air conditioning, and cable television. Both signs were set into a patch of grass lined smartly with small white painted boulders. The blue van turned off of the road and onto the lot of the inn, crackling the small bits of pale dry gravel into itself. The hand of the driver popped out of the window and flipped the butt off into the dried up patch of grass below the signs, where it fell to its smoldering death. The motel was a one-story strip ranch laid out parallel to the road, painted white with pale blue trim. All units had front side ground access. A large sign centered atop the roof, certified Creekside Inn, in blunt black letters. The van bent right and peeled up to the center of the building, where a single unit protruded forward from the rest of the layout, and a small sign above the doorway stated Management Office. The brake lights flashed and the van jerked to a halt. And that's how chapter one ends, right there. That's a lot to read, I gotta tell you what. That is not fun for a guy like me, but hopefully I did a good enough job for you all. A buzzard blinked. Now that reminds me, you know, talking about buzzards in Georgia, I had a couple of cousins, probably still there in Georgia somewhere. In Georgia, and one particular cousin lived in a small, no account town called Rutledge, Georgia. And I remember visiting one day over there, and I remember across the street there was this large water tower, and up on the top of that water tower there had to be like 72,000 fucking buzzards hanging out up there. It was an incredible sight. Like, I'm not a stranger to buzzards. You know, where I grew up in New Jersey, there were buzzards, but man, I never seen so many in one place. It was a freaky thing, the water tower in Rutledge, Georgia. And, you know, speaking of North Georgia, North Central Georgia, I heard from an old friend the other day. It's been 5 or 6 years since we've spoken, right? Good dude. Guy I met on the job when I lived out there. And he's an interesting dude, right? He's an interesting dude. He is what we call East Indian, you know, by background. He actually grew up in England. But he come over here, and he's as American as any American I ever knew in my life. And him and I were just like two peas in a pod. Not to say that we're exactly alike. We're not. We have a lot of differences. But I think, like, I talk about all these hobbies I have, right? I regard that as kind of a lust for life. And that guy's got it, but he's got it, like, even more so than me. He likes things more than I do. I like a lot of things. He likes what he likes, but he likes him more. I'm a little bit reserved on how much passion I have towards the stuff that I am passionate about. So we differ in that, but we differ in a lot of things. Our backgrounds are different, you know, for example. But like him and I were able to just immediately, we hadn't talked for 5 or 6 years. We get into a phone conversation that lasted about 40 minutes. We're into it for like 40 seconds, and we're already talking about the shit you never talk about in polite company. politics, religion, right? Just right into it. And we don't see eye to eye, but we can talk and we can talk and it doesn't matter, you know? It's like the good old days, like when you can have differences and get along in spite of them, right? And it was just, it was a good time to just have one of those kind of centrist conversations with somebody, right? And him and I, we can always do that. We can always talk like that. I'm sort of kind of like his older brother, you know, when we get together. A little older, maybe wiser, no more intelligent, probably less intelligent. A dude's an engineer, college graduate, entrepreneur. Really, really interesting person, right? Interesting person. And he's Hindu, right? He's Hindu. Obviously, I'm Orthodox Christian. I mention that all the time because that's what really matters in my life, right? But he's telling me he's like hooked up with this Christian men's group, specifically like a bunch of evangelicals. He didn't use that word, but he described what he was hearing and what the experience was like. And I told him that's what it was. When I said that, he's like, yeah, that's what it is. And he's just like talking about how just weird it was. Like he was learning about Jesus. They weren't really convincing him of anything. You know, he was kind of coupling his newfound knowledge of Jesus Christ into his Hindu tradition and how it all ties into it, right? What I mean to say, basically, like a lesser rendition of Christ. Christ is like a fully human, but not fully God, right? As anybody who's not a Christian would, at best, attribute to Jesus Christ, right? You know, as a man, he's maybe a prophet, maybe just a good, wise teacher, shit like that. And the Hindus kind of have that look, at least whatever branch of Hinduism he comes from, right? So it's like a minimalistic view of who Jesus Christ is. And so he's with these other people and learning, you know, what they got to say about it. And all he could tell me is like, you know, I'm there like to hear some things about Jesus. And all these people want to talk about is politics, 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 politics. And it's all in the, as it pertains to, quote unquote, end times, right? And like I've experienced that, and it drove me fucking crazy. And I, you know, it's like I left one men's group that just everything was end times. I went to another one, and it was like also like a month later, everything was end times. When this fucking COVID shit, oh, the end of the world, the sky is falling. Yeah, things are fucked up and things are crazy. It may or may not be the end, but you know, my Bible, my faith is not about how things end. It's how things are, right? And yeah, I don't want to focus on that shit. I don't want to be wrapped up in the politics and everything going on. That's a trap of the devil. And a Christian should be able to recognize that. I know we do get trapped. We have our vulnerabilities, our weaknesses, and we get stupid. We get trapped. But man, you know, of all places for him to end up, I gave him links to, there's in Orthodoxy, there's an offshoot of the Syrian Orthodoxy, the Antiochians, that's Indian by culture, right? It's a culturally Indian Orthodox Christianity. So I gave him the links that to something in the Atlanta area. We'll see if that picks up with him, you know. But it's like, you know, end times everything. End times, time, everything about time. You know, I shared an experience in a recent episode where I got to serve at the altar in my church, and I'm going to do that going forward. What a remarkable experience was. But, you know, what I didn't mention is there was a certain timelessness about it. Like, time was not passing. It was not passing slowly. It was not passing quickly. I was probably up there for like 4 hours or more. It could have been 40. It could have been 40 minutes. There's just no telling. Like, time wasn't moving. It was timeless. It was weird. I was in the presence of God, and God is a timeless entity, an entity that lives beyond time. And like, I was experiencing that timelessness. So it's like in the presence of God, in a place of God, and worship of God, time don't fucking matter. So why are we focused on the end of time when it don't fucking matter? Right? What matters is that we're ready when it happens. And readiness is your faith and what you're doing with that faith. Anyway, wow, preaching. See how I could preach? I could do some hellfire and brimstone if you really want me to. But, hey, the guy told me, anytime. And he wasn't really leaving it open. He's like, get off your ass and get out here. He said, you have a home in Georgia. Almost brought tears in my eyes, you know? just to hear that from anybody, but an old friend in a place like that, you know, it was a hard time for me. But I told him what's true. It's hard for me to leave Texas, you know. It just is. Whenever I do, I'm not gone long where I'm like looking back over my shoulder and it's like, you know, even though I live in DFW and DFW sucks, it's still Texas. And when I'm away from here, things feel weird. I mean, that's how Texan I've become in time. And it just reminds me of a George Strait song from his Straight to the Heart LP in 1982. A song called I Can't See Texas from Here. It's kind of Western swing. It's upbeat, you know, upbeat. Bob Wills and the Playboys kind of music. Very traditional Texas country. I can't see Texas from here. He's talking about being in places like Tennessee. And it's like, it's all right. And the people are nice. But I can't see Texas from here. And that's how I feel when I leave. You know, that's how I feel when I leave. Anyway, it's time for me to cut out. I hope you enjoyed the first chapter of this old fiction. All right. Adios.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.